The Discoveries of Nag Hammadi and the Plan of Salvation. This is a detailed chronology of the discoveries at Nag Hammadi, Egypt. The discovery of what is probably one of the most fabulous and important libraries coming from the first four centuries of our era has been designated by the scholar Jonas as one of the most sensational events in the history of religious historical scholarship, which archaeology and accident have so lavishly provided since the beginning of this century. Consisting of nearly 1,600 pages and bound in 12 volumes or codices and one tractate, the discovery made at Nag Hammadi, a little town across the river in Egypt, in 1945 was made public in the Cairo Press on the 11th and 12th of January, 1948. Notice how that coincides with the discoveries announced also of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Both the Nag Hammadi and the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in 1945, both by Arab boys, both with the name Muhammad. What a coincidence. And then it was announced to the scholarly world on 8th of February, 1948, in a communication by Professor Pusch and Jean de Ressay, his pupil, in the Academy of Inscriptions in French, in France. And on the 8th of March, 1948, by Togo Mina, who was the curator of the Institute of Egypt. Now, de Ressay and Pusch and Togo Mina played important and critical roles in the rediscovery, acquisition, and initial translation activities associated with the Nag Hammadi. All of this seems to be happening under our noses and without much notice. Since 1945, over 100,000 documents have come to light, which shed a tremendous flood of light on the world before Christ, as well as the world shortly after. All of the discoveries confirming, embellishing, and establishing a cosmic organizational and doctrinal view which is incredibly similar to that which Joseph Smith taught the world 147 years ago. Now, Dr. Truman Madsen writes, such a cosmology is shown in these documents. It involves the preexistence of all mankind, all intelligences. It involves teaching of living prophets, councils and groups, a quorum of 12. It involves patriarchs and prophetic blessings, a panoply of angels and archaeons who visit mankind, descending and ascending. It involves ordinances which are eternal and exceptionalists, through which men have contact with the mysteries and powers of godliness. It speaks of sealings. It speaks of becoming a possessor of the all and the fullness of the glory of the Father, not simply becoming like Christ in some distinct behavioral sense, but like him in nature, power, and dominion. It speaks of the sacredness of ancient Israel, its scatterings and gathering, of the creation drama, of the patterns of rising and falling which resemble in breathtaking similarity the ups and downs of the Book of Mormon. It speaks of glory, of light and fire. It speaks of transmitting these blessings by the laying on of hands. And with the current year, when I was preparing this, the Anglicans, who had not heretofore done it, began to lay on hands in their ordination procedures. Why? They are trying to conform with the practices of the first and second century Christians. It speaks of the early church as the extension of Christ's will for mankind. Now, translation of these documents will continue until nearly every unique doctrine, organizational aspect of the restoration of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will be confirmed, and most of it is confirmed today. It has taken the better part of 27 years for scholars to translate the contents of the first four caves of the Dead Sea area, but much of the Dead Sea Scrolls, 95%, yet remains untranslated. And yet, in 31 years, only 30% of the Nag Hammadi material has become available for review and examination, and most of the latter has been available only within the last 2 years. Discoveries are yet to come, as explicitly stated in the Book of Mormon in 1 Nephi on page 24, 25, and 27. In terminology, doctrine, and unique aspects of these books, and now contemporary theological writings, they pick up phrases which we thought as LDS scholars and writers and believers that we alone knew, such as the New and Everlasting Covenant, Zion, New Jerusalem, People of God, Major of Creation, a Heavenly Mother, Imperishable Spirits, Council in Heaven, The Plan, the special role of Enoch, Elijah, and dispensations, washings and anointings, preexistence, foreordination, sealing, signs, names, and rites for the dead, sacramental prayers, exactly as we have them restored to us in the Book of Mormon and the and the Doctrine and Covenants. Baptismal prayers, exactly as we have them. Creation stories, man as a secret name of God, the heavenly church in degrees of glory, and the kingdom of no glory. Abrahamic astronomy and eternal creations, thrones, powers, kingdoms, dominions, and active cosmic relations. Michael and Raphael, the garments of the priesthood and ordinances, weddings, rituals, eternal marriages and marriages above, even the mirrored bridal chambers, white robes, prayer patterns, orders, Urim and Thummim, and many others. All of these are elucidated in the new discoveries made just since 1945. There is a broad metaphysical, theological, cosmological underpinning of the saving power of knowledge. It is, first of all, a transcendental genesis, says Dr. Jonas, narrating the spiritual history of creation as a history of the upper world, ultimately of the deity itself, beginning with the first beginnings. And the great narrative these documents disclose unfolds the inner divine drama in whose course the lower world originates. There is, secondly, the outcome of this transcendental genesis, the existing system of the universe as a power structure which determines the actual conditions of man. The emphasis here is on its stratification along a vertical axis, on the antithesis of the heights and depths, and on the distance between the terrestrial and the divine world, and the plurality of worlds in between. No other people on the face of the earth were conversant with all of these in detail except one church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. 146 years ago, projecting to the world that they had a restoration. A restoration of what? That which the ancients had had, but how could you prove it? Now you can prove it all. The third theme, prepared by the first two and explicit in their logic, is man, his nature and his place in both the past history and the present system, and his origin beyond in connection with the pre-cosmic divine drama, his composite sunken condition here and his true destination. Finally, the doctrine of salvation, individual and universal, the last things answering to the first, and the reversal of the fall and the return of all of the things to God. One factor is the peculiar status of knowledge in every one of the stages. A lack of knowledge is at work in the arrogance and delusion of the demiurgical creation and is permanently embodied in the resulting world. A lack of knowledge inflicted by the world and actively maintained by its powers characterizes man's inwardly existence, and a restoration of knowledge is the vehicle of salvation. Since each of these conditions follows from the preceding one, the whole can be considered as one grand movement of knowledge in its positive and its privative moods, from the beginning of things to their end, every episode productive of the next, and all of them phases of one total evolution. Now that's the whole thing in summary, but let's go back now to the discovery of the documents themselves. The 61 religious treatises bound now or anciently found in 12 books and one tractate, probably up until the discovery of Algeria, the oldest books in the world. Then a little book was found in Algeria. It takes 40 pages of German material to just Xerox it. That's the oldest book in the world now, and it's of the Manichaean discoveries, and there will be a whole tape on that in the future. But these were found by some Egyptian peasants near the little place of Hamradam and Daba. They were in search, of course, for manure and guano in the southern part of a cemetery near the modern village of Kinabaski in Egypt, just across the Nile, where the railroad crosses the river from the town of Nag Hammadi. And so from that little town of Nag Hammadi, mostly a sugar cane area, a sugar factory area, that's the name now given to the documents, Nag Hammadi. This is sort of a real quick summary of just what happened there. In 1945, some Egyptian peasants, digging in an old cave for bird manure to enrich their fields, made a discovery that has enriched the entire scholarly world and produced a harvest of knowledge concerning a movement that contended with Christianity for supremacy in the 2nd and 4th centuries. In a large jar, these peasants discovered 13 codices of handwritten material compiled into books, bound into books, which had evidently been collected by a group of Gnostics, which is the Greek word for knowledge, or someone interested in the movement. The story of the manuscripts from that day to this has been an interesting one, involving intrigue, claims and counterclaims, war and strife, vengeance, murder, assassination, and smuggling. Now, nearly 20 years after the discovery was first made public, and after only a fraction of the texts have been translated and published, enough material is at hand to attempt a survey of what has been discovered and what the scholars have made of it. The site of the discovery was the eastern face of the steep cliffs at Jebel El Tarif, a huge range of cliffs. This is a picture that I have here. The LDS people should have known about this because 2.5 years ago, in their publication called The Ensign, a picture of this discovery and announcement of the documents and their content was prepared. This great huge cliff face was the site of a series of monasteries, the site of St. Pachymonius' famous monastery. Here, 60 miles downstream from Luxor, or north of Luxor, the Nile makes a great bend. On the western bank is the little town of Nag Hammadi, and amid fields of sugarcane, the villages of Deba, Es Sayyad, and El Kassar occupy the river valley on the eastern bank. The limestone cliffs face the bend to the south and turn northward to face the east, and from the great cliffs they go off into the great Egyptian desert. Here near the village of Hamradam, a cemetery had been located in the face of the limestone rock. Tombs, the highest up, were of local rulers of the 6th dynasty of Egypt, about 2,300 years before Christ, while those lower down in the base of the cliff were from the Greek-Roman period. In one of the cave tombs, supposedly, the peasants found a large jar, which, when broken, was found to contain these 61 books. In 1950, Jean d'Orsay, a French scholar who was very capable in Coptic, in which the text had been translated from original Greek forms for the most part, was guided to this spot by some peasants, who, thinking the objective of his visit in the area was to visit some nearby tombs, guided him on their initiative to a row of shapeless cavities in the cemetery where the great zur, or jar, had been found. The vase was broken, and little remained of it. Perhaps the lid of it was recovered a year ago or so in excavations being conducted by the Claremont Graduate School over here near your area. The manuscripts had been taken to the Coptic Abuna of the Deir el-Malik, which means they simply took it to their priest. His name was David. He even tried to read them. He even made a notation or two on a couple of documents, and that was how we were able to eventually identify some of this activity. But he was unable to read the ancient Coptic, a Sahidic. It was not his particular dialect. And so, in vain, he attempted to do something that was impossible for him. He scribbled on the margins trying to make some identifications, which he later admitted that he had been the one responsible. D'Orsay then talked with other Zundri individuals who had been connected with the discovery and who had even handled the documents to gather some of the particulars of the discovery from the Bedouins. The actual founder was missing. He had committed murder in vengeance for his father's death and was absent. He was to be remet nearly 30 years later. The codices were in excellent state of preservation. 4 were virtually intact. 6 were complete. 2 were fragmentary, and the final one, later called the Young Codex No. 1, had missing pages. Now, of the 13 codices in one tractate, or 12 in one tractate, 11 retained their original soft leather binding and resembled modern briefcases tied with leather thongs. 12 of them were about 5.5 by 6 inches wide and 9¾ by 11¼ inches high, so they were pretty good size. Codex number 2, the most beautiful and voluminous of the find, was 8¼ inches by 10½ inches and contained 175 pages. They were written in Coptic script, using Greek capital letters, and with the addition of 6 letters of the late Egyptian demonic Sahidic dialect and many other Greek words. The dialect belonged to Middle Egypt in the area near Akhamim. And by the way, about 100 years ago, a little better than that really, there were several discoveries of similar material at Akhamim in Egypt. And some of them have been identified as being part of the same library, the same kind of material, but involved with another monastery. Pachmonius, who initiated the great monastery movement in the year 320 A.D., was at least involved with 10 great monasteries. One of the reasons Jean d'Orsay was so interested, all of the tombs and all the great discoveries like King Tut and others, of course, occupy the minds of many people. But exciting to others are those who realize that there were monasteries throughout the landscape of Egypt. And when you think that in such places as Oxyrhynchus, that about 80 years ago, discoveries were made of Greek material and New Testament gospel unknown, fragments of the sayings of Christ, stuffed in crocodile skins and in rubbish heaps, and associated with a monastery where there were 12,000 nuns and 10,000 monks, where's the library? So the question was interesting raised. why not find a great discovery of library in Egypt? Well, without deliberation, it's beginning. Scribes who came to Kinabaskin from other areas to these monasteries probably wrote or translated or copied these documents. They may have been written elsewhere, brought here, and then compiled and bound into books somewhere before 367 A.D. Greek originals are behind all the writings. Some experts have been able to identify that some of the Greek originals may have been prepared before 120 A.D. So it takes us back into that first and second century milieu in terms of doctrines and ideas. In the translation, copying, and etc., much of the material became perverted, and there's a lot of bizarre material added. And so it takes an awful lot of scholarship to be able to get down to the layers, the original layers of material. Some Syriac and perhaps some Aramaic originals may be behind some of the documents. Most of the works were probably composed several hundred years earlier than at the time they were deposited. One of the codice bindings had a letter dated around 339 and referred to another series of people who we know to have existed around 354 A.D. So the period of a few decades before 400 A.D. is approximately the time these were bound up and prepared and then put in a jar, sealed with bituminous material, hid in a cemetery across the river from the Nile, near the ancient monasteries of Pacmoyas, and then not discovered until 1945. The codices were sold for 3 Egyptian pounds, about $1, by the peasants who found them, and were brought to Cairo, where they were sold to 3 purchasers. Codex number 1 was bought by an antiquities dealer by the name of Id. He was a second-hand dealer, and he purchased these a year later, 1946. There were some pages missing due to mishandling. Codex number 4 was bought by the Coptic Museum by Togomina, and 11 others from 1946 to 1949 were shrouded in obscurity, though gradually acquired by the daughter of a coin dealer, the Tari. And from her, through protracted negotiations, the government finally were able to obtain these. Actually, they involved themselves in a 7-year seizure, but they finally paid her 50,000 pounds, as far as I've been able to confirm. Now, below Luxor, the Nile describes a wide curve westwards in the neighborhood of the town of Cana and of the temple of Dendera. For here, it has to flow around the southern extremity of these lofty cliffs, the desert area. At this point, Jebel Atarif rises up majestically. And it's from this area that great discoveries have been made in addition to Nag Hammadi, the Bodmer text just recently identified. And there may be others made this winter. There's now a team there working in both the monastery area, looking for the rest of the cemetery, identifying 173 other tombs in the region, and working up in apparently an area where some other documents were recovered a few years ago. So they hope for some additional discoveries this winter. The Nile then approaches the vicinity of Nag Hammadi and makes a complete semicircle toward the south before it resumes its course northeast. The loop in the river is nearly 5 miles in diameter and encloses between the river the white cliffs of the eastern desert, the dense plantations of sugarcane replacing the acacia plantations of earlier times. It's in this loop that the hidden villages of Kusar, Sayed, and Beba are located. There's a Greek-Roman cemetery located 100 yards of the desert that stretches from the east, from the foot of the cave-lined faces of the cliff. Just down below the cliffs, you get out into the floodplain. And some areas of the monastery have been reburied by water and mud over and over the centuries. This is a small little arable tract of land. This is what involves the community and the sugarcane industry around Hamra Dome, so some 6 miles northeast of the modern city of Nag Hammadi and almost due north of Hu, formerly the Roman garrison of Dicopolis Parva. And then between these two monasteries stretches a little isolated desert, which is the site of the first monastery and monastic labors of Palamon and his disciples, according to the ancient Coptic texts. Probably he was one of the first real monks out there. The cave is still there, and is supposed to have been his hermitage. To the north, beyond the tilled land, orchards dominated by square towers and great canumbraries, and there rises the enormous abrupt cliffs of the Jebel Atarif, shutting off the whole horizon from west to east. A railroad now passes this quiet way, crosses the river Nag Hammadi, and continues on to the south. Eastward, the cliffs curve back towards the north and fade away into the depths of the desert, away from the Nile and its fertile banks. On the eastern slopes of the mountain, not far from Hamra Dome, are found the ancient remains of the region, galleries pharaonic tombs of the princes who governed the district under the 6th dynasty, 2300 years before Christ. These are located halfway up the White Cliffs. These galleries were one legendary among the seekers of the treasures of Coptic and ancient Arab Egypt. The first tomb from the south has painted in red Coptic some of the words of Psalm. And to the north at the bottom of the slope, a small sheik, a rustic holy place is indicated by votive caves and stones and indicate the place is still held in veneration by even the present-day Arabs. Inscribed in the finest of the tombs are a series of invocations showing the spot had been venerated by the Greeks as well. Now, Jean Durassay, the French expert, describes his visit there in 1950. Underneath the yawning entrance to the great tombs, he says, the face of the cliffs is pierced by narrow, deep cavities in which bodies had been summarily interred. Sepulchres are scattered about to as far as 100 yards from the cliff. Then he goes on and describes a lot of this in his book, which he prepared. It was one of the first on the Nag Hammadi in 1959. It became available in English and has just been republished last year. This great ancient cemetery now serving the cities of Parva and Kinabaskian is a very poor area. Until recently now, the region of the present Nag Hammadi was little known. It's lost its greatness after a great plague in the year 806. Nearly 15,000 inhabitants at that time. The Coptic name for the little town, the latest form of an Egyptian name, means the Cassias of the god Seth. And by the way, in some of the documents in Nag Hammadi refers to the god Seth and to his Sethian documents. Now in the year 320, young Pacmonius had been conscripted into the Roman army, been converted to Christianity. He was liberated from a Roman prison and took up residence near this area. He soon became a disciple of that ancient monk, Palamon, and became the director of a local community order. He was the one who established the monastic orders and monasteries. They stemmed from him and his disciples. Soon he had 10 of them. Now we go back to 1946. Togo Mina and Albert Id, the two figures that are very early in this situation. In 1946, a middleman from Upper Egypt showed documents in Cairo to the Coptologist George Sobey, who was a member of the board of the Coptic Museum. Sobey directed him to Togo Mino. He says, go see Togo, who was the curator of the Coptic Museum, who on the 4th of October 1946 acquired those documents that had been given to him at a very modest price. I think he had four. At least sheets of Codex I at about the same time were acquired by the Belgian antiquities dealer Albert Id in Cairo also. Other codices were brought to Cairo by other middlemen, and several were offered to a scholar who did not acquire them, much to his chagrin, and many years later. These became part of a larger group of 9 codices, which included Codice 2 and then 4 to 11, and parts of 3 others, which were collected by the antiquities dealer and by Mrs. Marika Dattari. Thus, a library of 13 documents emerged, though most of the codices are still being sought, or were at the time I prepared this. Now, nearly everything has been returned to Egypt, even the one that was smuggled out of Egypt to the United States and ended up in the library of Carl Jung, the psychologist. Jean Durassay, in September 1947, arrived in Egypt for the first time. His wife had known Togo Mino, and she had met him, and they had received a letter from Togo that he had some very interesting things. They were very curious as to the circumstance and situation, and maybe I'll have time to give you more details on that as we pursue it. But in September, he arrived. Togo showed him the documents, and immediately Jean Durassay was able to read the documents and recognize them for what they were. So between the two of them, they began to try to track down the other documents. He wanted to depart immediately to the area where they had been discovered, but there was an epidemic of cholera at the time. Many thousands of people died. He was unable to get into the back country in order to pursue his desire. So he had to spend most of his time making acquaintance with the collections there in the museum. And then that was when Togo Mino showed him the documents. With Togo Mino's permission then, Jean Durassay made the text known to another Frenchman, Drioton, and to his own teacher, Dr. Push. And they agreed to invite them to join a committee to publish the text. They also sought the assistance of W. Till. These are the men now who have been instrumental in many things regarding these documents. It was Dr. Till who was working on a previously unpublished Berlin codice that was very similar. He had been commissioned by the German Academy to publish the Berlin documents. But in trying to trace the origin of the manuscripts, the most he could learn from various persons who spoke mysteriously of this large manuscript find from Hamradom, north of Luxor. So it was a very difficult thing. Togomine advises the Council of the Coptic Museum to acquire all the documents, since Jean Dressé was able to identify their significance and meaning. And so an effort was made. The government was involved. However, the material that it had disappeared from the country before arrangements could be made. He took them out of Egypt to America, and then he died. He passed away. Apparently his wife was able to get them into Germany, or into Europe at least. And then they were offered for sale to Dr. Jack D. Barrett of the Bollingen Foundation in Zurich. The story continues, of course, and a great deal of the story will be prepared by James Robinson, who is now the individual in charge of the United Nations excavating team in Egypt, and they're there now. And so I'm giving you a quick summary here. But $12,000 was paid for the smuggled books in the summer of and winter of 1948 and 49. This permitted the book to be given as a gift, as a birthday gift, to the psychologist Carl Jung in Vienna. And then the estate of Carl Jung, after his death, worked with the Egyptian government, and that document was returned to Egypt a year ago last winter. So now all of the books are back in Egypt. And Dressé was contracted by the foundation for an assessment of its importance, and he would, of course, be able to verify its value. And negotiations and all that story will be available in the future. Now we go to a man by the name of Giles Crispell. He was professor of early church history at Utrecht. He was a visiting professor of the Catholic University at Louvain. And two of his documents we have used in showing parallels to LDS doctrines. He gives an account of his exciting story in his study from Istanbul, which I acquired a number of years ago, and the deciphering of the Nag Hammadi, their discovery and recovery. It's been a very thorny path, and great difficulties were encountered, and credits are due to those who helped, but has not been given. It is sad that Dressé himself was passed over in silence and became sort of left in the backwaters of what happened thereafter. And there's a great deal of chagrin and bad feelings in certain circles around these discoveries and their bringing forth. But after his original work in 1945, Crispell and others extended their work to include the texts that were smuggled into Vienna. And after considerable work, he managed to track down the whereabouts of some other of the documents. On May the 10th, 1952, Crispell acquired at Brussels a Coptic codex of 100 pages, which contained four unknown writings from the 2nd century A.D. And in the spring of 1948, he had already received some documents before. And at that time, Crispell had been engaged for several years in the study of Valentinius, who was one of the most important of the Gnostics. He had sort of been up for Pope at a certain period of time. When he didn't make it, then he apostatized from the Catholic Church in his day and went out on his own. And he was able to contend with the Orthodox Christianity of his day on a number of points. The Gospel of Truth, therefore, which had been much known to have been in existence about 150 A.D., was entirely found in the codices of Nag Hammadi, which seemed to be Valentinius in origin. Now, there are a number of other very key people who have been involved in these documents. We'll touch upon a few of those. Dr. Meir and Crispell were involved quite early with the documents, beginning by 1950. In August 1950, Crispell again instituted an investigation at Paris on behalf of the foundation and finally established that the codex reposed in a safe in Brussels. On the 9th of July, 1951, Dr. Meir of Zurich, succeeding in discovering the address of the new owner, was able to pay the price for the codex. And so it was eventually acquired and made a gift to Carl Jung. Let's go to the young Marquia Datari. Dressé's inquiries as to the origin of the documents, having led no further to their origins, except for some fragments from the Shepherd of Hermes in the Machamim dialect, and probably from the same Nag Hammadi discovery, he left for Upper Egypt. He traveled by plane, then rail from Cairo. For a period of time, however, the rail transportation was suspended. Then at Luxor, he spent long weeks exploring the ruins of the monasteries and trying to find out details, which we mentioned to you earlier. He returned to Cairo, but just before his scheduled return to France, Togomino had been persuaded that nothing more remained to be rescued to the discovery. They'd only got a very small portion of it. But they decided then to announce to the public the discovery. On the 11th and 12th of January, 1948, the Egyptian press revealed the discovery, which made no great stir. Who was interested in Nag Hammadi or whatever they had in there? In a country, of course, that was sort of satiated in terms of great discoveries, particularly gold and whatever may be in these great tombs and so forth. But what Gerasse did not know, that was one of his colleagues that had the opportunity of seeing some other manuscripts in Cairo, and they had been offered to him. He did not find them of interest and mentioned them to no one else, which was a gross misjudgment. And the discoveries then were turned down. Marika Datari, perhaps because of what had been revealed about the value of the manuscripts, guessed what these writings might be and what they might bring. And so in October 1948, she wrote John Gerasse a letter after she had laid her hands on a number of the documents. He received word from her in confidence, and there were some photographs and manuscripts soliciting his advice. He immediately recognized her connection to the Nag Hammadi discovery, and through the efforts of R. Dussaud and Schaefer, he arranged to leave France and return to Cairo immediately without delay. And what was shown to him were most of 9 documents in bindings of soft pliable leather, but he was allowed to only make a rapid inspection to identify the principal works. Egypt was now at war with Israel. The United Nations on November the 24th had declared Israel a state, and the War of the Republic was in progress, if you recall, in the account of the Qumran scrolls. And on the fateful night in Jerusalem, on that night, November the 29th, Sukinik had identified the antiquity of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And likewise now, over in Egypt, similar things were going on with the Nag Hammadi. The French director of the Department of Antiquities, Druton, Gerasse indicated that the library was being acquired by the Coptic Museum, but Mrs. Datari submitted the documents to Togo Mina, who presented a preliminary analysis to the board of the Coptic Museum, which agreed that funds for acquisition should be obtained and authorized Gerasse to make a more complete inventory. He announced the discovery on June the 17th, 1949, and a month earlier, the Israelis and Arabs had reached an armistice. The codex were placed in security, since no modification of their content could take place. There was an assassination of the Prime Minister of Egypt, and of course Nasser took over soon thereafter. The suitcase in which Datari was showing John Gerasse the documents was sealed, placed in the Department of Antiquities, was unavailable to anybody for 7 years. Professor Labib became director of the museum in 1951. Togo Mino died. But before the study of the documents could begin, the revolution in Egypt, July the 23rd, 1952, had resulted in the entire reorganization of antiquities, and all the French were depossessed and deported. They were required to leave Egypt. So therefore, a settlement on the documents could not be concluded until 1956, at which time the contents of the suitcase were declared national property. And by a court action, Mrs. Datari was eliminated in terms of her possession and rights. But she persisted, and I think eventually she was remunerated, but very small compared to the value of the documents. So there's a lot of problems, legal things of that kind that were involved. People were very dissatisfied with the Egyptian government, and it finally required the United Nations to get in on the act. But on information obtained in Upper Egypt and from the various persons contacted while trying to trace down the discovery of the manuscripts, Gerasse, in January 1950, visited the Nag Hammadi area, and we described that visit. He also was able to, from his notes and everything, and the few times he had a chance to examine many of the documents, he was able to prepare a book, as I mentioned, in 1959. His activity and work, of course, part of a very extensive material being prepared. I think a few other people might be of interest to you. Let's go to Soren Gevierson. Scholars from countries not involved in the Suez Crisis were able to visit Cairo and examine the codices. One was Soren Gevierson, who worked at the Coptic Museum from November 1957 to January. He came from Denmark to Cairo in 1958, and he photographed, he was an excellent photographer, codices number 2 and 3 for the Institute of Egyptology at the University of Copenhagen. Alexander Bolig, also from Germany, was in Cairo in 1959, and he visited the Coptic Museum. He received permission also from the present curator, Labib, at that time, on January the 30th, 1958, to gather some of the material. Push and others were able to visit and publish some of their work. The once official group that had been assembled to try to do the work and everything had to be reorganized on several occasions. A third wave of publications began in 1962, and 63 when the editors of the Young Codex published their writings on the resurrection. And finally, new factors altered the situation in Cairo and led to the publications by new scholars entering the field. The world was now becoming aware of the discoveries of Nag Hammadi. The first publications were with Togomino and John Dressay, Till and Push and a few others. And then John Dressay's work came out sort of independently, alerting the world to the voluminous value of the Nag Hammadi. And then Gevierson and others making available their photographs permitted or were able to stimulate a new wave of translations. But it wasn't until last year when Gevierson's work on what we call the work of John, a lost book of John, became available in translation, which is so essential to understanding the 27th page of the Book of Mormon, 93rd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, the 88th, 84th, and the 76th, and section 9. Now, Martin Kruse became involved from the German Archaeological Institute in Cairo. He worked at conserving the documents. Now a technical effort was being made to do something with those documents. He went to the Copying Museum in early 1959 and worked there until 1962. He put the Nag Hammadi documents under 1,300 panes of plexiglass so that then they could be examined and photographed and worked on. In 1947, portions of the manuscripts had been conserved in part between some panes of glass. Then they'd been transferred in 1965 to the plexiglass covers. Labib and Gerges, then the creator of the Copying Museum, had also placed other sheets in 1956 under plexiglass. And the rest of the library was preserved then by Labib, Gerges, and Krauss. Krauss also completed his edition of three copies of the Apocryphon of John and published these in 1963. Alexander Bolig published in 1962 the tractate without title, and in 1963, four others were published. Now, Krauss made an inventory of the books, which supplemented that made by Dressay. And then they issued a revised English text of John Dressay's book in 1960. This marked the end of the great decade of research and publication following the discovery. Dressay now withdrew from the work on the documents. He was to resume several decades later. And about 1973, he received a copy of the LDS documents, the Pergate Price, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants. He realizes certain parallels in those LDS documents and the work he had been doing over the decades. By 1965, Labib, the director of the Copying Museum, had assigned a total of 23 of the writings to scholars so they could be prepared for publishing. Some of the work was being done by Dr. Wilson in the Britain area, and a whole series of works were being published by Dr. Bullard on the nature of the gods, which has interesting parallels also. Professor Labib retired as director of the Copting Museum in 1965 and was succeeded by Habib. Arrangements were then made by United Nations, UNESCO, and Arab agencies. They were slow in maturing. By November 1963, only 423 pages had been sent to Paris for photography and reproduction. And then by 1966, 1,076 pages had been prepared and identified, but only 762 were available for work and translation. Then in 1966, in Sicily, at Messina, University of Messina, a whole series of conferences were held, and here the world began to really move in a positive direction. Krauss, Soderbergh, and then the newly entering scholar, Dr. James M. Robinson, prepared an appeal to the United Nations, urging the completion and restoration of the entire project, and through their efforts, the Cultural Department, the Cultural Activity of the United Nations was made, and then the Israeli War, 1967, the Six-Day War intervened, and again, they had problems. It took until 1972 before the documents were finally available in such a manner they could be totally photographed, and most of the photographs of the Nag Hammadi document weren't available until just last year. So you can see the whole intricate story. Publication plans for the tractates were assigned and made to a number of individuals, but little progress was made by 1968. At that time, only 20 publications had appeared. The United Nations program was limited to just a photographic reproduction, so an international English language edition was planned under the auspices of the Institute for Antiquity and Christianity of the Claremont Graduate School through grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
That book appeared 3 weeks ago. The Nag Hammadi Library in English translation. All this is just the English translation with some introductions of those 61 tractates and books. Commentaries and other material necessary to understand and critical studies and things will take years to prepare. But now this is available for our students of the Nag Hammadi. An entire monograph series entitled The Nag Hammadi Studies was launched by E.J. Brill, the publisher in Leiden, Holland, and that's where I get most of my books, by the way, in 1970, and included on the editorial board was Jean de Rassay, the Frenchman, who 23 years later had been in the area. On 16th of November 1970, Gamil Mokhtar, Under Secretary of State in the Ministry of Culture, in consultation with the United Nations, issued invitations to a group of foreign scholars to a meeting of the International Committee in Cairo on the 15th and 18th of December 1970. And in two work sessions, a technical subcommittee including Gavirson, Kase, Cross, Dr. Robinson, and Dr. James Brashler, who now participated in the general editorship of this document, established original pagination so they know the pages, assembled the fragments, supervised the final photographic work, and got things off to a good running start. By December 1972, preparations for the last volumes of the photographic facsimile edition were completed. But that was just the work to do it. It's taken 5 additional to 6 years to finish the photographic work. And up to that time, there was only about 29% of the manuscripts that had been available for study and publication. Now the facsimile edition. The photographic reproduction has appeared in print. The Gnostic Library is a complete edition of the Nag Hammadi Codices and also the Codex Berlinensis 8502, which is associated with it, the one that was in Berlin found earlier. Each codice, tractate, with notes and indices and complete critical text and English translation and introductions will be presented in a uniform edition. This is now a major project. A whole series of experts now are working on a complete, comprehensive study and commentary of each of the Nag Hammadi books. In all of the years since their discovery, the first volume appeared less than 2 years ago. A number of others are ready now for printing. They've been sent to the publishers, and they'll be appearing this year. I don't think you want to know who are all the international committee members and who are involved and all those doing the translating, because they're part now of that particular book. To kind of update now some things that happened just recently. In 1976, 75 and 76, a team of men under United Nations auspices and other supporting institutions and with concessions from Egypt returned to the area to try to find the original discoverer, to see if he couldn't really tell them when that jar had been found, to find out if there might be other documents available. This is a picture of the team who went there at that time. Some of them I know personally, and the leader of the group, Dr. James Robson, is a personal friend of mine. And the first year, or first excavation summary, has been prepared, and then they returned again a year later, and a second series of excavations and studies began. They identified 178 tombs and cemeterial areas. They only worked on about 8. And so it's going to take a long period of time to examine. They also were able to find in this wadi, up this particular area up the great cliffs, evidences this is where the Bodmer text came from. And if you want to know what the Bodmer texts are all about and a few other discoveries, that'll be the subject of a future tape. We'll have to get involved in that a little later on. So a team of men now have been consistently returning to Egypt, and they left last November. Next month, and in fact during the next 90 days, excavations and mapping, I was supposed to be there, and I just simply have not had the time to be able to make available to go over there to do some of the mapping. But at any rate, the team of men are there now working on a whole series of things that you'll hear about probably if they make essentially new discoveries, and they're bound to next year or a year from now. So teams and men are working on the Nag Hammadi to translate, to find, to recover, to prepare and provide the world at large with the contents of these great discoveries. One of the individuals working on these documents is Jack Finnegan here in the Pacific College, who also directs trips into Egypt and elsewhere. He has worked with the translation summaries of a whole series of fragments. His book in particular has provided evidences that the LDS claims for a restoration are quite positive. A year ago, last October, this book, The Laughing Savior by John Dart, was published. In part of the opening paragraphs, he says this, Mormon church professors are looking for traces of first century Christian rituals and are looking for this material, of course, to try to confirm their own documents and concepts, which they feel were abandoned by the church and restored when the Mormon church was founded. Scholars at large are quite familiar with the mileage the LDS church is getting from these new discoveries. At a breakfast meeting, and after an evening of presentations by Dr. James Robinson and Dr. Brashler, and then all morning sessions, some of the material that they had been working on just weeks before were found to be contained in the different sections of the Doctrine and Covenants. And at their request, I provided two of the leading experts on Nag Hammadi with copies of the Mormon Standard Works and other material on the temple, which has such great parallels in the Nag Hammadi discoveries. What's the future going to bring? Three things are emerging that we can now see. First, we really don't know too much about the people who prepared these. There's a lot of guesswork going on, a great deal of controversy as to when and what. The chronology is a little difficult to reconstruct from the documents. So until they're all translated and made available and the critical apparatus applied, we really can't make too many conjectures at this moment. But it does seem that at least there was a group of people on the Nile River who possessed certain documents, and an edict came down to destroy them. The contents of these were in variance and directly opposing Orthodox Christianity of the day. And the contents, some of it even bizarre and perverted, nevertheless contained essential teachings that had been prevalent in the first and second century. Documents that by the fourth century were totally removed from Christian teachings. By the year 1829, 725 Christian churches no longer taught what the first century Christian church had spread abroad. Such doctrines of preexistence no longer were being taught by the Christian churches in 1829. A whole series of peculiar teachings concerning the Heavenly Mother, preexistence, the councils of heaven, and all that we earlier described to you in the first part of this outline were now absent from the teachings of Christianity. Then Joseph Smith, a young man endowed with tremendous spiritual authority, represented himself as being an instrument in the restoration of what the ancients had and the primitive church. In 1,800 pages of scriptures and diaries and pronouncements and dialogues and teachings, he provided a total, reconstructed, detailed teaching that he called the gospel. And then he went on record as saying, "An evidence for this will be found," even specifying that it would come in a very short period of time. Now the discoveries quite plainly point out that every one of the organizational practices, unique teachings, and salient doctrines of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints restored in 1829 to 1844 when the prophet Joseph Smith was shot to death are now confirmed and found in these ancient documents. The challenge, of course, to the world at large is to study these documents and refute, if they can, the restoration. It'll be impossible because of the overwhelming discoveries being made there and elsewhere. The distinguishing opening volume of the publication of the Library of Nag Hammadi appeared in 1975. It's called The Gospel of the Egyptians. And for this present study, Volume 1, in a series of parallels to the LDS Plan of Salvation, will utilize those materials and others available. LDS scholars are now, of course, involved a great deal. Some are involved in the excavations and they're participating in the work going on. And many of the leading scholars, the Nag Hammadi and the Qumran documents, realize that they are providing proofs and confirmation that the Mormon claims, as laid down 146 years ago, are accurate and true. The significant religious position, then, of most Christian denominations is precarious. The Catholic Church has issued a series of encyclicals since 1964 trying to conform over to the nature and character of the teachings of these documents. The effort is rather interesting because most of the materials they're changing over has been part of the LDS Church and religious practices for over 100 and some odd years. Orthodoxy and heresy. We all know that enormous importance is attached to the concepts of history and of Christianity. And all through these things, an interesting thing is emerging. The period of Christian origins is, as a rule, passed rather briefly. What did really happen in the end of the first century, in the beginning of the first century? And by the end of the third century, those who were in authority and power, on what authority did they remove certain teachings? In one of the texts of Nag Hammadi, the author at the end of the book is saying, you are no longer the true church. It's criticizing the Orthodox Church. It states there, you have removed the temple work, the marriage ceremony, and certain other sacred doctrines concerning the preexistence and the Heavenly Mother. And because they removed these things, he states the church in his time was merely now becoming the instrument of the adversary. It appears that perhaps heresy of the 2nd and 3rd century may have been true orthodoxy, and orthodoxy by the 3rd century had become true heresy. Now the contest is open. The documents are confirming the LDS position. The challenge of the world is as a whole to pursue it rigorously, to study it, to read, to learn. For most Latter-day Saint people, of course, this may all be interesting and just nice to know. The fundamental aspect, of course, is the fact that even though publications are being made that show all these confirmations, the LDS person is challenged, and you in particular, to read and study and pursue it rigorously to find out if it's really true. Not the Nag Hammadi. Whether or not it's true or not really is not important. But is the Church of Jesus Christ really true? And there is in the content of the Scriptures themselves provided in the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, the key. If the fountainhead of all truth is Jesus Christ, and if he is a living God, and if there is deity, he can confirm individually to each person a private and personal testimony. This is the thing each individual should be encouraged to do. Not to become involved totally on the basis of the confirmation all the documents might provide, but humbly kneeling, ask deity, is the Church of Jesus Christ really true? And then by seeking and by private prayer and humility and humbleness, confirmation can come and has come to many. And then these other discovering these great documents merely confirm the Church of Jesus Christ is true. And may you get a testimony of it. In Christ's name, amen.